Nice to have you here. We'll take your phone calls throughout the morning and your text messages with Kevin Dietz and myself, Tom Jordan, with you till noon today. It's 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. All right, so this morning, want to get this out of the way because this is breaking this morning. The number of illegal border encounters since October the 1st has already surpassed 1 million. This is a record. It has never been this high before. So this is what, October the 1st through February the 6th, which was yesterday. That's like 100,000 encounters higher than the same period last year. So it's only getting worse, as we've seen over the past, 3 years or so. It's getting more and more open, I guess. The border is becoming more and more porous. And so this is the earliest the U.S. has ever reached the 1 million encounter mark. That's according to CBP. They're also tracking a higher number of Chinese migrants crossing the border. Chinese illegal immigrants made up the fastest growing group of border crossers last year. And, Kevin, what I found interesting is a lot of them are flying from China to some South American country and then right to Tijuana. Taking a plane to Tijuana so they can cross the border right there into San Diego. So from Tijuana, Mexico to San Diego, they got their little bag in tow that they just got off the plane in Tijuana. And I've been to that airport a few times. It's not far from the actual border crossing, so they can literally take a plane from China to Tijuana and then walk right across the border into the United States.
Well, you talk about the border. I just feel like the Republicans completely botched this Mayorkas impeachment, Tom. They had the ability. We talked about this. They had evidence months ago. They had evidence years ago. And they waited until now to do this impeachment after Joe Biden says, hey, I'm willing to work with the Senate and do a deal.
Right.
And it's these Republicans who don't want to do a deal. And then all of a sudden, oh, all right, we're going to have this impeachment. Oh, wait, we don't have the votes for the impeachment. We're gonna vote in a way that we can bring it back up later. Mm-hmm. If they had done this impeachment 6 months ago, they would have had the votes. They would have got the impeachment. The Senate would have not have confirmed it, but they would have been able to have the hearings, get the information out there. But they're so worried about timing it with the election and all of that stuff.
I think one of the reasons was because of the Kevin McCarthy situation. That was why it got postponed for so long, because that was a huge, in my view, still a mistake.
One of the reasons, but even all along there, though, we're not like the Democrats. We're going to make sure we have all of the evidence. We're not going to do anything until we have McCarthy could have impeached Mayorkas before he even was called on to vacate. And the thing is, now here, it looks like the Republicans just don't have evidence against Mayorkas, and there's so much evidence against Mayorkas. And the reality is their timing was terrible. And had they done this 6 months ago, then Biden would have come out, because he would have had to, mm-hmm. and say, "Oh my gosh, we have to do something about the border."
Right.
And it would have just the view of it would have looked like, "Oh, the Republicans pointed this out. They impeached Mayorkas. The American people see what's going on. Biden has to respond. Thank you, Republicans." You're not getting that feeling right now. The Republicans are bumbling and fumbling through this whole thing.
You know why that is, though? Because the Democrats had steered the narrative to do that. And they would have done the same thing even if Mayorkas was impeached, because they're very good at doing that. The reality is this Senate bill never would have even been addressed if it wasn't for, I think, the Republicans taking the House and starting these various investigations.
Of course.
But the narrative gets changed by Joe Biden and Democrats because they're very good storytellers. So even if Mayorkas was impeached last year, they still would have somehow turned the story on Republicans. Say the reason, they could have done something last year. Instead, they focused on impeaching Mayorkas.
The Republicans don't have to help them along.
No, I agree with you.
Very disappointed on how that played out.
For sure.
Favorite headline, I think, overnight is Nikki Haley loses to, quote, none of these candidates. This is amazing. In Nevada's presidential primary, of course, Donald Trump not on the ballot there. Some other Republicans were, Tim Scott. And a couple of others.
Yeah.
But none of these candidates was also on there, and none of these candidates came in first place. Nikki Haley comes in second place. A clear indication that people in Nevada would have voted for Donald Trump had he been on the ballot.
Yeah.
And a clear message to Nikki Haley that, look, it may be time to shut it down. But she said, no problem. This is nothing. No big deal. deal, on to the next state, on to the next primary. We're going to keep this thing going all the way till victory.
Yeah, her reasoning is that, you know, that Nevada was never behind her in the first place, so she hasn't spent hardly any money there. She's spent hardly any time. I think her last time there was in October. So she's kind of, you know, just kind of pushed Nevada aside. And by the way, the primaries don't count anyway in Nevada because they got the caucuses there tomorrow. Right. That's where they're going to choose other delegates for the nominee. And Nikki Haley decided not to take part in the caucuses. Same for Tim Scott. It's Donald Trump now who's going to likely get all the delegates. So he still will take Nevada, even though on the primary for the Republicans, he was not on the primary ballot. It's confusing the way they like to change things up in these various states regarding the primaries and the caucuses and the combination of, but not much different than what we're going to do here in Michigan later this month.
We have to,
Republicans have to have a primary and a caucus because of what Democrats have done.
Not a great look for Nikki Haley.
It's not, though.
To none of these candidates. We talked a little bit about this yesterday, or the speculation of Tucker Carlson interviewing Putin. Tucker was reporting on X last night from Russia. And he said the interview with Putin is on. It's going to be 2 hours. He said Elon Musk will air it without edits. He said Tucker paid his own way over there. Nobody is paying for this. There will be zero influence over the questions that he asks. He says this interview will be free to watch. There will be no paywall. And he says the American media has failed the American people by constantly interviewing the leader of Ukraine. And he described those interviews with Zelensky as fawning over him, mm-hmm. as pep rallies.
Oh, they sure were.
Not a lot of hard questions about where is this money going. And he said that's a disservice to the American people. He said, why has not a single Western journalist gone to interview the president of the other side to get that perspective, to see what's going on? And you can say, well, because Putin's just going to lie. We already know who Putin is. We already know he's going to lie through his teeth. Fine. And Tucker Carlson said, that's fine. He very well may lie through this entire interview, but we as American people should see that. We should have the information. We should be able to look at that and put that into the pile and assess that information as we determine how long to keep funding a war, how much money to spend there instead of spending on the border. He said this is an interview that absolutely has to be done, should be done, and should have been done by all members of the media.
Here's what has changed. And I was at Hillsdale College yesterday speaking to some journalism students, and I was describing to them one of the things that have changed so much in the journalism industry is that reporters now and newsrooms around the country have decided who is and who is not worthy to be given a platform, meaning we're not going to interview certain people and ask difficult questions of them. We don't do that anymore because we've taken sides. And this is not how it used to be. I mean, can you imagine Sam Donaldson back, you know, 20, 30 years ago with ABC News, of him saying, no, Mr. Putin, I'm not going to interview you because you're the president of a country that I dislike.
Right.
That would never have happened. We know that Mike Wallace, the same thing with 60 Minutes. They would go to these countries that were enemies to the United States, and they would interview the leaders. We don't do that anymore. And if you do it as a reporter, somehow you're labeled as supporting country.
It's called omission.
Yes.
And so these stories, you never see them because nobody ever goes to get them because they don't want you to hear the opposing viewpoint.
Exactly.
And so it's omission. Yeah. And do you know what the liberals on social media have determined with all of this yesterday?
Well, I'm sure.
I mentioned they didn't want Tucker Carlson allowed back into the country.
Yeah, of course not. He's a traitor now.
But now, they're calling this treason. They'd like him when he. They said no. Let him back in, and then arrest him immediately for treason.
See, this is the whole insurrectionist argument.
Right.
It's not unlike what's happening to Donald Trump right now. It's amazing how this is getting portrayed in the Western media. I'm glad he's interviewing. I hope we ask him if it's some very difficult questions. Quick break. Kevin Deese, myself, Tom Jordan, back after this. 760 WJR. Jennifer Crumbly convicted of 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter for her role in her son's mass shooting at Oxford High School. Her role mainly being negligence is what the argument has been for quite some time as the mother of the mass shooter at Oxford High. And I think it's a significant case, obviously, Kevin, in holding parents accountable for their children's actions. Obviously, disagreement on this, but the jury, they agreed.
They did. And, you know, I was not a huge fan of this time. I thought, you know, to charge the parents, they should be part of the conspiracy. They should have helped plan it out or something. But I said, look, there's obviously a lot of problems with these parents. Go ahead, let them charge. Let the system play it out. Take it, make the case, take it to a jury. That's what they did. They got a guilty verdict. And I wasn't there for all of the trials. So I'm down with this. I'm good with this. I hope it sends a message to other parents to pay attention. And I hope it prevents other school shootings.
Sure.
And I hope it saves lives.
Yeah.
And I hope it doesn't become a slippery slope of charging parents for their kids' crimes. But let's get into this one with Todd Flood with Flood Law. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, guys. I'm great.
Appreciate you being here. We're getting a lot of reaction. We're starting to hear from some of the jurors, the foreman anyway, at least, about what their thoughts were. As you look at this, what do you think convinced the jury to go guilty unanimously?
I think if you just start on November 30th and you look at the meeting that the defendant had with the principal, the counselors, and others, and you see that diagram. If you had that diagram in front of you and you just looked at it for a minute and saw the gun that was drawn on there with the identical gun that the defendant gave to her son. If you look at the imaging and the words that go along with it, blood everywhere, thoughts don't stop, and a person shot twice, just start with that and then go backwards. But what would a reasonable parent do under those circumstances? I can assure you the three of us here would have said something to our son. And especially if the school would have said, you know, you need to get him into counseling right away. I would have called work up and said, I can't come in today. But, you know, neither here nor there. That's not extraordinary effort by us. That's not extraordinary. That's just ordinary care. Keep on going back. They locked the kid out the night before. There was messaging shown that, you know, the defendant knew about her son's plight. So this is not a case that is of first impression from the standpoint of holding parents accountable. It is the first in our history in the United States that a mass shooter was in this position where the mother and the father gave the kid the gun knowing he had mental issues. So, but we've had, just look at Virginia, you know, mother is charged because the 6-year-old takes a gun into a school and shoots the teacher and injures her. This is, I think, a fact-based case. And I am hopeful that this is not now all of a sudden going to drive knee-jerk reactions. Because, you know, for prosecutors to charge crazy cases, this wasn't that. This was based on facts. And due process won, right? They put it up in front of a jury. It went all the way up to the Court of Appeals prior to that. The Court of Appeals and the conservative court at that said there was enough probable cause for a crime to be shown and probable cause that this person did it. So it went to a trial. I think I'm with you, Kevin. I think it was a fact-based case, and it was the right verdict. And it's not new. It's not new to us in the state of Michigan.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the system, and they brought it. They put the evidence out there. Jury looked at it, and they had a unanimous conviction. So I have no problem with it. I'm curious. I guess this is speculation. Maybe not fair, but is there a point where the jury may have gone the other way? Say she did stay home. Say she did call and take him right to a counselor that day, and she talked to her son. Would those three things be enough, or would she have had to call police as well? Would you have to turn your kid in? How far do you have to go, do you think, to meet some sort of burden of responsibility that would not lead to a crime?
So the standard and the jury instruction says ordinary care. To get to gross negligence, you know, you have to have a lack of, you know, giving ordinary care. Had she just done it, hey, Ethan, where's the gun? Or Ethan, what's in your backpack? Or to her husband who was in the room with her, do we know where this gun's at right now? Or to tell, you know, the principal, we did buy him a gun for Christmas, you know, something of that extent. Those are steps of ordinary care that I think vitiate or cure her criminal responsibility. You know, the jury foreperson had mentioned to her or to the media that, you know, and left it at this, that she was the last adult with the gun as they understood the facts. So I think if there would have been just a step in the direction of caring, she truncated that meeting to 11 minutes and said she had to get back to work. She said she wouldn't change anything except for I wish she would have shot us. Not that I would have wanted the gun taken away. Not that I would have, you know, wanted these four lives back and the others that were shot, you know, their injuries not to have taken place. None of that. You know, so how did she look at this world? It seemed to be she was self-serving statements. And you know, when you watch that police video, she's asking the question why, as opposed to and then leaving her son, as opposed to the husband in this case. You know, he's devastated, but and I love you. You know, I mean, you could see him in a different position. So I don't know. I just thought the government and the prosecution in this case had the facts, and they charged this case based on facts and law. And we've had, you know, one case that we've talked about in the past where a young lady, a young girl, 8 years of age, lit a house on fire. Parents knew she had issues with lighting things on fire. It was an apartment complex and killed the child. The parent was then charged with involuntary manslaughter for not keeping these matches and incendiary devices out of her hands. So that's all the way up to the Court of Appeals. It was reasonably foreseeable if you put something of a dangerous weapon in this young lady's hands that a bad thing would happen. It's the same thing in this case. You put a gun, think about it, guys, a gun into this kid's hands, and you see all his disturbances. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out something bad was going to happen with this.
Yeah, the gun is probably one of the biggest things. And her statement about, you know, she wouldn't have done anything differently. I would have thought as a parent that, listen, looking back, knowing what I know now, this is what I would have done differently. But I don't know if how much she was listening to her own attorneys on that and how much of that was just her own statements, her own feelings. Very much appreciate your perspective on this. Todd Flood, attorney at Flood Law. Thanks so much, Todd. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
All right, you too. Yeah, it's difficult, Kevin. I mean, how do you predict violent behavior? And is it necessary now for families to know all the potential scenarios that await their kids?
Well, when you see something, say something. But if you're the parent, you better say something. You
yes.
better do something. If you do nothing, this might be your plight.
We'll be getting into your calls in just a bit here at 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. Your calls are coming up in a bit. Hang tight. We've got a lot to talk about this the rest of this hour. It's 800-859-0WJR. So the U.S. Senate, the so-called border security bill that they have put through, it's likely not going to pass. Not because the GOP wants to make it political, but the exact opposite. The bill in the Senate is political in itself in a political year when the issue and its root causes have been ignored by President Biden and this Democratic-controlled Senate until it became politically expedient. This is my view on this. And border security prioritizing lawmakers like Congressman Jack Bergman, they've criticized the Senate's bill, this version of border security, for failing, Kevin, to actually address the ongoing crisis at the southern border.
Yeah, the Democrats wanted the Republicans in Congress to be the bad guys on this who clamored for border security and then refused to back this bipartisan Senate bill, which apparently isn't very bipartisan because they don't have the votes in the Senate to get it to happen even. A lot of problems with this right out of the chute. A lot of questions of why bring this if the president isn't even doing all he can through executive order at the border. Let's bring in Rep. Jack Bergman, Congressman from the 1st District. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, gentlemen. Great to be with you.
Well, I appreciate you being here. We've heard from folks on both sides of this issue. When you look at what was presented, are you surprised at all that this thing is not going to make it?
Absolutely not. And I was listening as you guys were kind of characterizing the elements of it. I mean, the Senate border bill, doesn't do anything to help with the crisis that we have down there. It just kind of normalizes it to a greater extent. And the key here is that only roughly 17% of the $118 billion deal is being allocated towards border security. So where is the other 82% going, if my math is correct, or roughly? Doesn't include critical asylum reforms. It gives, again, more bureaucrat authority for blanket catch and release authority, permits the president's abuse of the parole and system, and bankrolls the transportation and housing of the illegal immigrants into our communities with our taxpayers' dollars. The president already has authorities. He has 8 authorities that he could do this without any kind of bill. But as we have seen for the 3+ years of the Biden presidency, he does not exercise the executive authority he has. And I'm not going to say he's hiding in the basement. That's not fair. But the point is, somebody who's running the show over there is afraid to exercise legal and leadership executive authority that we so badly need in our country.
You know, Donald Trump said a bad deal is worse than no deal on the border. Others have said the American people don't want compromise at the border. They want border security. But Democrats have said this is better than nothing. This does move the needle. This does make America safer. So why not put this in place and then continue to work?
Well, again, you got to remember you're talking to a Marine. And I'm used to securing a perimeter, and I'm one of the 3 Vietnam vets left in the House of Representatives. And the question we would ask from our perspective, exactly how many Viet Cong snipers are you willing to allow inside your wire before you say, okay, that's too many? It's asinine at its best. It's evil at its worst. Because it shows then intent by members of this administration to basically subvert our country and enable those bad guys. And these are really bad guys. I mean, the number of terrorists that we don't know that have infiltrated through the border, roughly 63 different countries these people are coming from. It's not just Mexico. It's not just the triangle down at the tip of Central America. We are failing when I say that the we here is largely the administration and the watered down DC view of the world that doesn't really reflect the safety and security that all of our American citizens not only want, but they need to be able to live their lives.
You know, James Lankford, he's a pretty conservative senator, and he's defended this. He was one of the key negotiators in this. And he says, listen, right now, let's bring up the asylum issue, for example. He says, right now, you can just come across the border and simply say, I'm afraid of my country, and they'll let you in for like 10 years. But he says under this bill, you can say you're afraid, but you've got to prove it. It's got to be verified, according to Senator Lankford. What do you make of that claim by the senator, and why do you think he, as a conservative, is so supportive of this?
I think one of the things that happens in D.C., and maybe to an extent in Lansing, too, or any state capital, there is a capital view of the world that doesn't necessarily reflect the reality of the greater world around it. So when you have people here who are elected, and I know Senator Lankford, he's a good man. He's a conservative. He's a man of very, very, very defined and deep faith. I think in his case, he's trying to get good things done. But I talked to him the other night, and you can see the frustration on his face. And people are hungry for some kind of positive something out of D.C., even if it's, as you said, well, it doesn't cure the whole problem. Well, again, security, the number one mission priority of the commander in chief, and that would be the president, is the safety and security of all our citizens here in the United States of America. That's it.
Yep.
Everything else is secondary. And Washington, D.C., so many times has its own myopic view of its role in actually providing good outcomes. There's too much politicization, if that's like, I'm not sure I got all the numbers, right syllables in there.
It's close enough. We understood
that's where it is. Yeah.
Well, you're right. I mean, there is too much. And the complaint from Democrats is that the GOP is trying to politicize this when, in fact, I look at this bill as a political bill in nature because they've ignored it in this entire time. And you've in the House, you've already got the Secure the Border Act. That is your preferred solution to actually securing the border. How different is that? What specific outcomes do you expect from, you know, H.R. The House's version of this from that implementation compared to the Senate's bill?
Well, H.R. 2, which we passed, you know, 9 months ago or thereabouts, to put into place the necessary reforms to actually secure the border, to end a lot of the policies. I was down on the border with Speaker Johnson here, well, first couple of days of January. If I had to describe the situation down there in one word, it was sad. And sad because after so long a time, the situation has only gotten worse for our people trying to administrate, if you will, the Border Patrol, the Customs, all the folks trying to do the right thing, and for the people who are trying to come here legally. One simple thing that the administration could simply re-put into place, is the Remain in Mexico policy. Bottom line, yep. Come file your paperwork, mm-hmm. and then remain there. So we get it done. But H.R. 2 laid out enough details that where if we enacted it and put it into law, it now forces our bureaucracies here to actually work to solve or to mitigate the issue of the backlog, yeah. All the things that the procedures that need to be done to vet the people that are trying to come here. And some people you're going to tell no. But the thing is, think about what's called the gotaways, the people who've crossed but have never, ever been apprehended. We've got roughly a million. I think it's 860,000.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, total. Well, now it's total over the time. It's 1.7 million gotaways. Yeah.
Right. And those are the ones
we know about.
We saw them but didn't catch them. And there's a lot more on top of that. Unfortunately, we got to run here, Congressman. But okay. I'm grateful for what you're doing.
Thank you for your service,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, very much. Thank you for your service and for joining us. Congressman Jack Bergman, thanks so much.
Thanks, guys. Thanks.
Have a good one. Up next, we're going to speak with Buck Meyer, the father of Tate Meyer, one of the victims of the Oxford High School shooting, but the verdict yesterday against Jennifer Crumbley. Next on 760 WJR. I don't think anybody was watching this case of Jennifer Crumbley more closely than the parents of the victims in the Oxford High School shooting, which took place on November 30th, 2021. It's been a very, very difficult road for them in particular, and watching every probably word of this case to find out if Jennifer Crumbley would be convicted on these four counts of manslaughter. Well, she was yesterday, Kevin, and I think from what I'm reading, there's a sense of relief in some degree for the parents of the victims.
Yeah, Tom, the victims who died in the Oxford shooting are Madison Baldwin, 17, Tate Mears, 16, Justin Schilling, 17, and Hannah St. Juliana, 14. The entire community are also victims. The entire country are victims of a school shooting like this. Nothing will stop the pain of losing a loved one. The shooter was convicted and is serving life, and now his mother is also convicted, as you pointed out, four counts of involuntary manslaughter. Let's bring in Buck Merritt, father of Tate Merritt, victim in this shooting. Good morning, sir. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you being here. What is your reaction? What are your feelings about the mother being charged, and then your reaction to the trial and verdict?
You know, it was me and my wife were laying in bed watching the verdict. Actually, just took a couple minutes off work, and we're laying in bed watching it on our phones, and we were talking before the verdict and what we thought it would be and yada, yada, yada. And we talked about how we would feel either way. And, you know, we feel like, you know, the prosecution did an amazing job, you know, and the people spoke. And you know, for me, that was the most incredible thing, because, you know, if you've been following this case closely, you know, the people haven't been able to speak for the charges against the school, right? Or the claims against the school. So, you know, I don't feel like there's justice, because that Tate's never coming home. Yeah. We'll always have that hole in our family. So, you know, whether she got nothing or, you know, ends up being sentenced to max 15 years, I'm glad it sets a precedence. But at the end of the day, our son's not coming home. And that hurts, you know.
That's an impossible situation for you guys, and of course nothing is going to heal that or fix that. What is important is the possibility of this making parents pay close attention to their kids and possibly preventing another one of these in the future and saving lives. Do you think it will lead to that, or could lead to that?
You know, I mean, this is common sense to you know, our family. I mean, you got a kid that's struggling, you don't go buy him a gun and give him access to the gun. Now, if you feel like that's a hobby you want to take up that he might enjoy, and, you know, you do it together, you lock it up when you get home, you know, you show your kid responsibility of gun ownership, you know, you do it the right way. The way they did it is not the right way. They thought that buying the kid a gun was going to solve his problem. I don't know what they thought, you know.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know what they thought, right? But it's incredible to think that kid was that mentally ill, and they bought him a gun to make him feel better.
Yeah, I well,
for
that was
whatever reason that is.
Yeah,
right?
that to me was the most troubling aspect of this. Is there's a kid here who is obviously, as he just said, mentally ill. And then there's a gun that's been given to him at a very young age by his parents when there's no other support out there. And, you know, there's a lot of emotional testimony from families like yours in this case. And there's been a community call for accountability. Do you think this case will impact on a real down-to-earth level this conversation about gun ownership? And as you touched on, gun ownership responsibility and who should and who should not have weapons in their houses.
Well, I think this leads to, I think there needs to be a discussion about it. And here's the problem with our country, not just our state, our country. We can't sit down and have conversations anymore. Our politicians can't sit down and have conversations anymore and problem solve and represent all of the people. Right now, only extremists are represented in our government, extreme right or extreme left. Those are the only ones represented. I am not represented. I'm a moderate.
Yeah.
You know, and this is the problem here, is all we want to focus on is guns. When a school shooting happens, all we want to focus on is the guns. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have some tough conversation about that. And maybe there's no legislation that gets implemented. But why can't we sit down and have a tough conversation about it?
Yeah.
We can't, right? Because the extreme left wants to take guns away, and extreme right wants to say any legislation you put in place is taking our guns away. There's no middle ground.
Right.
Jennifer Crumbly said she would not have changed anything if she could go back in time. How frustrating was that for you to hear that?
It's not surprising for me to hear that. Mm. She bought her kid a gun.
Yeah.
You know, it's unfortunate.
Hmm.
You know,
do you look at these cases differently? I mean, this is just one of the parents. There's another parent coming up at trial there, James Crumbly. Do you view these their roles kind of the same and their level of responsibility and their guilt in this shooting as the same?
Yeah, you're both raising a kid, right? You both should be on the same page of what's going on. You should communicate. You should talk. You should get your kid help. I mean, they're both culpable, you know? I mean,
do you think that's far enough? Do you think someone at the school should be charged?
Yeah, I think I think what you guys need to do is talk about that a little bit more. You know, the school has not taken any accountability here.
Yeah.
When I think of November 30th, I think of four legs of failure. I think of the shooter, the parents, the school, and our community. Think about this for a second. I think of four legs of failure. Okay. The shooter's being held accountable by the system. The parents, leg number two, is being held accountable by the system. Our community, you know, I feel like 42 strong, the peer mentoring program we started is addressing the community issue. How could this kid walk through those hallways every day and not have a bud, not have a mentor, right? So three out of the four legs are getting addressed. What's the only leg left? The school. But the system is not allowing us to hold the school accountable.
Yeah, well, that is an issue we are going to continue to talk about even more so. You're right. We should talk about that aspect of this more because there were obviously clear failures prior to November 30th, but particularly on that very day by the school and by the staff and by the counselors. We can see that very much. I know this doesn't bring you a whole lot of solace, this latest ruling yesterday, but we're glad that it happened, and we hope in time you will heal from the loss of your just great child, Tate Muir, who was, of course, killed in the shooting. Buck, thanks for your time. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. God bless you. We're going to take a quick break. Back after that, 760 WJR. The South Carolina primary could be pretty consequential. Ronna McDaniel, she is, of course, the longest-serving chair of the Republican National Committee in modern history. Well, she's rumored to be stepping down after the South Carolina primary. And there's a lot of speculation that Donald Trump is promoting a successor to Ronna McDaniel, who, of course, hails from right here in the great state of Michigan. Now, Kevin, Ronna McDaniel, she's kind of denying through a spokesperson that this right now is the case. There are no plans. We're totally focused on South Carolina, but it does appear that this is going to be the case. There's been a fundraising issue within the RNC nationally, not just here in the state of Michigan, but when you compare it to the Democratic National Committee's ability to fundraise, there's been a pretty significant difference. So they're thinking for leadership change.
I don't know if anyone can do any better, because the problem, in my opinion, is never Trumpers versus only Trumpers. Mm-hmm. And those folks aren't going away if Ronna goes away.
Yep.
They are locked in. The people who are absolutely never Trump, and I'm talking just the Republican Party. The Republican Party are anybody but Trump or only Trump.
Yeah.
And they do not get along. They have no room for compromise. And they are not willing to throw their money to the other side. Like, so if you're a never Trump, you're not going to commit money to the Republican Party. And if you're only Trump and the Republican Party saying we're supporting somebody else, they're not going to commit their money. And you need the whole party to win. The Democrats seem to always, at the end of the day, everybody rallies around whoever it is. They collect an enormous amount of money and they go and they do the best they can and see if they can convince the American people. This infighting is fine with me up until you pick a candidate. And then once you pick a candidate, then everybody better get behind that candidate or you risk losing.
The infighting is fine with me so long as it's about policy. And a lot of this is about personality. They don't like him on a personal level. They don't like Donald Trump because he's offended them some way, somehow.
And they're not going to contribute to him.
And because of that, they're angry and they're not going to give him any money. But when you analyze the policies and what they believe in from a Republican standpoint, most of them agree on the vast majority of what the platform stands for, whether it's the economy, whether it's national security or foreign affairs, or even for the large part, the issue of abortion, you know, the pro-life sentiment amongst the conservatives. A lot of it is fairly similar, if not exactly the same. The difference being Donald Trump's personality. They either like or don't like. And that's, to me, the sad part of this.
You remember all those blue drones flying all over Detroit in support of the Detroit Lions, and they were making the form of a lion and reading out words like Detroit versus everybody.
Yep.
It was so cool.
Yep.
Well, there's a story here that a man facing felony charges for flying a drone over the NFL game in last week, one of the games. And it made me wonder, like, so this guy had no permit to do it. He went up and he got cool.
He had a permit.
Cool video of the game. Didn't have a permit. And it just made me wonder how comfortable are you with drones flying over various places?
Not very.
Like I'm thinking about the Mackinac Bridge and the Ambassador Bridge. I'd like to know that they're only allowed to go get beauty shots from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. and 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. And then I can choose if I want to go over the bridge at that time or like the Dream Cruise. There's all this drone footage of the Dream Cruise, millions of people out on Woodward Avenue. I don't know. Like, I feel like if there is going to be a terrorist attack, the next one will be via drones. These things can carry a lot. They seem to be able to pop up and pop down quickly. I don't know how much control we have over the drones that are flying.
Well,
we don't.
There needs to be a ceiling, I think, because a lot of pilots are very, very concerned about drones in the air. I mean,
you
get a goose that gets into one of these engines,
it
can bring down the plane. And so you look at some of these smaller municipal airports around town. What's to say they're going up? You know, I don't know, a couple thousand feet, and there's a drone up there. They can easily hit it. And I don't think most people in those areas, residential areas, are thinking about, oh, I got a ceiling here before I want to get a good shot of my real estate property or whatever it is. Yeah, it's. I think from the pilot perspective, it's very concerning. But then the national security threat. I haven't put a lot of thought into that aspect of it, but certainly, unless you're talking about those military drones, which are like millions of dollars.
No.
The common little consumer types.
No, I'm thinking of these little people who could, work out of their basement and attack like a lone wolf style.
Yeah, of course, it's possible.
It scares me.
You can attach a camera to it. You can probably attach a weapon.
I just thought they're all good people doing beautiful things, making the lions look good.
Yeah,
and then this guy got arrested, made me think twice.
Something tells me those people had a permit before they put up the blue drone. Detroit.
True. Hey, we just had a really good interview with Buck Meir, father of Tate Meir, one of the victims in Oxford. He talked about the four legs of responsibility in the Oxford school shooting, the shooter, the parents, the school, the community. He said three of the four were being addressed, but not the school. And we have some callers on that, so we want to get to it. 1-800-859-0957. You can text as well, 1-800-859-0WJR. Let's go out to Brighton and check in with Ken, who's retired law enforcement. Ken, welcome to All Talk.
Good morning, gentlemen. Absolutely awesome show as usual. Listen, a couple of points. First and foremost, God bless the family and the survivors. I have no idea how I would deal with that. Having said that, my major problem with this is that the school. Hang on one second. Sorry about that. The school does have a liability. I know they were ruled at some point during the process that they weren't culpable. This is my point. In that office, in that conversation with the school representative, principal, whoever it was, mom and dad, and the shooter, where was the school resource officer? I guarantee you that if that officer was called to the office, that gun would have been discovered because it's a matter of normal procedure in law enforcement. So that's all I have to say.
The resource officer, just for a matter of fact, was in another building ultimately came to the scene after the shooting. But there were other people. The principal was in a meeting with the parents. There were definitely people in authority at the school, but not the resource officer who was at another building.
You're correct, though. I mean, the school district and the employees, they've got government immunity is what it was ruled, and they can't be sued civilly in that mass shooting in Oxford High School. And you think to yourself, okay, well, how are they protected in that regard? We're just talking about a civil case here. This is even the criminal aspect of it.
Yeah.
And you can point to a number of things that had occurred prior to it. You talk about warning signs and being able to foretell if something dangerous is going to happen. And in light of the Jennifer Crumbly verdict yesterday, you would think that people that are very close to witnessing the drawings and speaking to
you want your schools to teach your kids. You don't want to add more to them. It's hard enough. But at the same time, if you're going to charge the parents for not seeing something, and the kids are with teachers for that many hours a day, maybe more than their parents are, it's hard to not see how they're held accountable. Yep. Appreciate it, Ken. Yep. Thanks so much.
Right. Ken, thank you.
Let's go to Gross Eel and check in with Matt. Matt, welcome to All Talk.
Hey, good morning. My concern is maybe I've oversimplified this, but boiling this down and from a 1,000-foot view, has this just either set precedent law that one human being can be criminally liable for the acts of another human being?
That's a concern.
That's kind of the, you know, $64,000 question here is, and to me, it's where do you draw the line on this? And, you know, Todd Flood, he's an attorney. He said, listen, this is not the first time we've done something like this to where we hold a parent accountable for in some respect to something that their child did, as long as there is really gross negligence involved in it. And they should have foreseen what was going to happen. But you're right.
I've got a couple other questions, if you don't mind. But so were there signs ahead of time before this incident when they had the meeting at the school? That's one. Second of, let's replace the item that was in that picture, the gun that everybody keeps blaming on. Let's replace that with another tool, possibly a hammer. Let's say that Ethan liked building birdhouses and the parents bought him supplies to build birdhouses.
Probably not. We're out of time here, but probably not. But if they gave him a knife and he stabbed somebody, yeah, possibly. Yeah. If they gave him the keys to their car when they knew he was intoxicated,
right,
probably.
Right.
So it depends on each circumstance.
Yeah.
But it's a slippery slope. It does concern me.
Good questions, Matt. Appreciate your call. More to come, 760 WJR. Well, this kind of puts a little bit of a wrinkle in Donald Trump's case claiming immunity. The Federal Appeals Court in D.C., they dismissed the case. President Trump's claim that presidential immunity shields him from prosecution for actions that he took while he was in office. And particularly in this context, relating to the efforts he made to contest the 2020 election loss and what he was doing. He says it was just the normal part of being president. One of his duties as president was to ensure that the election process was legitimate and not riddled with fraud, and so he should have immunity. This appeals court has denied that, Kevin, and so I guess the next step is either the case continues or he's going to the Supreme Court.
I'll tell you one thing, Tom. Donald Trump's going to have to start paying attention to what he's been charged with. He's just been,
too much out
charge
there.
Charge me with whatever you want. It doesn't matter. I was the president. I have immunity. And I was like, oh, wait, they can charge me? Wait, can I get a list of all the things I've been charged with? Those 90 counts that are like 600 years if convicted. I'm going to have to write some of these down. I'm sure, is going to go to the Supreme Court and try and get this decision reversed. But it's very interesting and raises a lot of serious questions. Let's bring in Andy McCarthy, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Good morning. How are you?
Morning, guys. How are you?
Appreciate you being here. As you look at this decision, are you surprised? And what kind of impact do you think it'll have?
I'm not at all surprised. But, you know, I think realistically, there's nothing in the Constitution that says the president has immunity. The Supreme Court gave president's immunity from civil suits in the early 1980s, but they kind of made that up. They derived it from principles in the Constitution. Today's Supreme Court probably wouldn't have done that because they're much more wedded to text and the original understanding of the Constitution. But if Trump has a chance to talk a court into giving him immunity, the only court I think realistically that could do it is the Supreme Court. The lower courts, no matter what you think of how the lower courts have handled his cases up until now, they faithfully applied the relevant Supreme Court jurisprudence. There's no case on point about whether a president has immunity from criminal prosecution. It's just the Supreme Court's never decided it. So the only – if you're going to follow what they've done and what they've the direction they've gone in up until now, this was the result that was going to happen. And, you know, Trump might as well get on with it with the Supreme Court if he wants to press it.
Yeah, if there's nothing in the Constitution and if the Supreme Court does its job, Trump will have no relief there. Do you think this will encourage more criminal cases to be brought against Donald Trump?
I don't. I think that the immunity thing started out as important to Trump more for timing reasons than substance reasons. I don't know that he ever really thought he was going to prevail on the immunity question, even though he's been, you know, railing about it. The reason it was important to him is in federal criminal law, you're not allowed to appeal most of the time until after the trial is over. you know, you have a trial, the guy gets convicted, and then he appeals, and you appeal everything at once. There are a few issues that you're allowed to appeal pre-trial. One of them is immunity. So immunity became important to Trump because he's trying to string this out because he'd like to delay the prosecution beyond the election, hoping that if he wins, then his Justice Department would dismiss the case, right? So that's the important thing for him on this. But in the interim, the other thing that's happened is the Supreme Court agreed to hear the cases of some of the January 6th defendants who claim that the Justice Department is misusing the obstruction statute against him. That obstruction statute is central to Trump's case, and the court is not going to decide that until June. So really, I think immunity has kind of run its course as an important issue, but what really matters in this case is what the Supreme Court does with the obstruction issue in June.
Andy, can you explain that? Why is the obstruction statute, why is that central to this case with Donald Trump?
So it's not, there's no law on the books that says, obstructing Congress by preventing them from conducting a proceeding, in this instance, to ratify the election result, right? So the Justice Department creatively has used an obstruction statute that really usually applies in the business context and has to do with destruction of evidence, like manipulating documents and shredding documents and stuff like that. And what they've tried to do is apply that to the Capitol rioters on the theory that they obstructed Congress from holding the joint session to ratify Biden's victory. And then even more tenuously, I think, they've applied it to Trump on the theory that he was positing what he knew to be a bogus legal theory that the vice president had the authority not to count electoral votes, which I don't think that's a proper use of the obstruction statute. If the Supreme Court, I think it's more questionable for Smith, the prosecutor, to have applied this obstruction statute to Trump than it is for the Biden Justice Department to have applied it to the rioters. So if the Supreme Court sees it the way I see it, they may throw out those obstruction charges. And if they do, that's going to require a major overhauling of Smith's case.
Yeah, it's so complicated because that would also, that application to the obstruction of Congress, and as somehow Trump knew that this was a whole bogus theory that Mike Pence could have certified the electors. They got to prove that he knew that it was a bogus theory when, in fact, it seems a lot of evidence that he truly believed that he can do that. I want to ask you this because he has until Monday, I think, to decide if he's going to appeal to the Supreme Court. And from there, I guess the Supreme Court can take it on their own timetable. But until Monday to make a decision, that seems like a very small window, a small timetable. Is that usual for a court to do? Could it be in order, do you think, to expedite the case so that the trial resumes sooner rather than later?
Yeah, so there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. Trump has 90 days to appeal to the Supreme Court. No court can change that. That's what the rules say. But the court is in charge of what's known as the issuance of its mandate, which means when it issues its final formal opinion, which then gives the case back to the lower court so the lower court can act on it. Right now, jurisdiction over the case is only in the D.C. Circuit. Judge Chutkan, who was the trial judge, can't act on the case right now because it's in the circuit court. So the court is in charge of when its mandate gets issued. And what they're saying is to Trump, look, you have 14 days to move for rehearing before the whole circuit, which they'll never grant. And you have 90 days to appeal to the Supreme Court if you want. You can take as much time as you want. But if you appeal by Monday, then we'll hold the mandate. So Judge Chutkan still can't act on the case. But if you dither and wait and, go beyond Monday, you can still appeal, but we're giving the case back to Chutkan so she can start doing the stuff she needs to prepare for the trial.
Yeah.
So I think what they did was proper because they didn't have to withhold their mandate at all. They could have just issued it. And what they're saying to Trump instead is, we'll withhold it, but you got to get on with appealing to the Supreme Court.
We only have about 40 seconds left, but does Donald Trump winning the election solve all his legal issues? Will the pardon save him, or are there state charges that, if convicted, he could not get around?
Yeah, well, the state, I think the thing is, if he gets elected, that wouldn't, he could make the federal cases go away. I mean, he might get a hard time. The Congress could impeach him for pardoning himself or dismissing cases against himself, right? So he's got to worry about that.
There we go, man.
As far as the state cases are concerned, I don't think they could go forward because he'd be president. The Supremacy Clause would be invoked, and they'd say, like, the states can't prevent him from acting as president. They'll have to try him after he gets out of office. But he can't make the state cases go away.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. But they could be delayed at the most. Okay, very much appreciated. Love having you back on the program. Andy McCarthy, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York and contributing editor for the National Review. Of course, Fox News contributor as well. Andy McCarthy, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Have a good one. All right, quick break back after that. 760 WJR. A lot of issues we are talking about. Just spoke about Jennifer Crumbly's conviction of manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter. Was it the right decision? I'd like to know what you think about that. Also, Donald Trump is not, at least according to this appeals court in D.C., allowed to be immune from his role in the office and as it relates to January 6th. That was a ruling. It might go to the Supreme Court. Do you like that as well? Give us a call. It's 800-859-0957. 800-859-0WJR.
Hey, we had some great guests this morning. Todd Flood talking about the Jennifer Crumbly conviction. Jack Bergman, congressman from the 1st District, talking about why he didn't like the immigration bill. We had Buck Meir, the father of Kate Meir, the victim in Oxford. And we just heard from Andy McCarthy in a really good interview. You can catch any of those. All you got to do is download the free WJR app. It's available now in Apple App and Google Play stores. You can also go to Amazon Echo, Google Home, and catch the entire show or parts of it whenever you want. A lot of conversation, Tom, about the Crumbly case.
Mm-hmm.
She was convicted. Jennifer Crumbly, the mom, was convicted for involuntary manslaughter. And was it the right decision by Karen McDonald, the Oakland County prosecutor, to charge in her son's mass school shooting? Or is it going a step too far to charge parents for the crimes of their kids? And we had Todd Flood on, and he said it depends on the circumstances. If it happens, this was the first time in a mass shooting where a parent was charged. But when kids get a hold of their parents' guns and the gun accidentally goes off in the house with the kids playing with it or whatnot, parents will get charged with crimes. This feels a little different. But there was a lot of evidence presented that there were things that Jennifer Crumbly certainly could have done and should have done differently. But you do wonder, is this just the beginning? Do people now look to this and say, hey, we have to charge in every crime of every kid. We got to get parents when the criminal is under age 18.
Well, this is the slippery slope that even Todd Flo was saying he was concerned about potentially occurring. And listen, the defense portrayed Jennifer Crumbly as a caring parent who was unaware of the impending danger. I think you got to ask, you know, what does this all tell us about really the challenge of foreseeing violent acts by family members ahead of time, like knowing that this is going to occur? And should families address potential warning signs in this matter, in the reality that, listen, this person is suffering from A, which will likely lead to B unless we intervene somehow. And if you don't intervene, will you be held responsible?
And must you call the police, or do you just sit them down and talk to them and see how they're doing? Must you get a counselor involved? Where does it begin and where does it end? And maybe that's how the more cases they have like this, I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
But in this case, they clearly felt in the unanimous jury verdict felt she did not do enough. 1-800-859-0957. You can also text 1-800-859-0WJR. Let's bring in Mike Parsons, who's got some text for us.
Yeah, we have a texter from Ohio says that gun laws make it illegal to purchase a gun for another person. These parents had to be aware of these laws. They were irresponsible on so many levels. Responsible gun owners should not be compared to these parents.
Irresponsible. It's clear. Yeah, they're irresponsible. But does that mean involuntary manslaughter? Why not gross negligence? And what's the difference legally?
Charge them with providing a gun for someone, buying a gun for someone.
The gun charge itself. Yeah. Right. If there's a law on the books regarding the gun and they violated that gun law, charge them for that. This went to a whole nother level, which I agree we have not seen before. Involuntary manslaughter. And you said something very intriguing, I think, at the top of the show today, that you can understand if, listen, they took part somehow in the actual process of being on camera. And you can make the argument, well, buying the gun for Ethan was taking part.
No, he never said he was going to use the gun to go shoot up the school.
Of course not, yeah.
He did not say that to them. If he had... I might feel differently, and I'm not wildly upset that she was charged. Carrie McDonald wanted to find out, so they tested this. This was the first case involving a mass shooting, and now they have an answer. If she had been part of the planning or brought home the school designs or said, hey, son, if you're ever thinking about doing this, make sure you go in this exit, you know, whatever. No questions asked. You're part of the conspiracy.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a little different, and it's interesting, and I think it's worth talking about. Let's go out to Steve in Sylvania. Steve, welcome to All Talk.
How you doing, Kevin?
Great, thanks.
So a lot of nuances that went on with that shooting, and I followed it pretty closely. I didn't look at the verdict too closely, but you know, my concern here is this: that is a one-sided prosecution. That school district, and if you bear with me for a second, has as much, if not more, culpability than those parents did, and I'll tell you why. They were in possession of the renderings that kid had that lit off that meeting where you had that counselor, his mother, Ethan, and I don't know who else was in that meeting. I don't know whether I was the principal or whether it was
the principal.
Yeah. Okay. When and I don't know when the last time any of you guys, my kids are out of grade school, high school. But when they, you know, when they were in grade school, you couldn't get into that school. They stiff arm you with the, you know, we got them from 8 o'clock in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We're taking care of this. You can't just walk in there and go to the classroom. That is, they present themselves as the protector of the school system, right? And they clearly failed there because they sat that kid down with those renderings and for whatever reason relented and let him back in that school. What that principal, with his fiduciary responsibility to the other students in that student body, should have done is said, "You can get all of the material you've got. We'll make resources available so you stay current. But until you are cleared by some sort of a psychologist, you're not stepping foot on these grounds again, because there is evidence time after time in most of these school shootings where you have some kid that is mentally off and." They know it, yet they let them back in, and they're rolling the dice. And no one has gone after the superintendent. I think the parents are suing
civil case.
Yeah, and they need to sue them to the point where they're all living underneath a viaduct someplace. Because if they're not going to go to jail, they need the punitive measure.
Why not test them criminally though? If you're going to test the parents for the first time ever, why not have the prosecutor test the school as well? Why do they have immunity?
Well, because they're part of the teachers union and they're part of the Democrat Party, and the Democrats don't ever do anything wrong. Let's be honest. They, you know, they'll point the finger at everybody else being wrong, but you know, God forbid that you touch the holy alliance that they have with the teachers union. And candidly, it is proven yet again to be absolutely abhorrent.
Yeah, I don't think the civil case, there should be immunity because in this case, I mean, listen, you got parents. I think there was a $100 million lawsuit against them, and there were clear actions that were taken that very day, including not even looking inside the backpack. It seems like an obvious thing when someone is clearly despondent in your presence right there. I appreciate the calls. We're going to take a quick break. Back after that in a moment. 760 WJR. Well, the UAW, they've been getting a lot of great news coverage, and they've been running several victory laps over the historic labor deals with the big three automakers. But it appears not everyone in the UAW membership is so happy with the union. And there's this organization, Kevin, called the Center for Union Facts that has launched a campaign to point out several things, but one of them being the union's socialist in far-left liberal political leanings that it appears they would like the membership to kind of fall in line with. And that's some of the concerns that some members have.
Yeah, people call me and they'll have a grievance, something they want to say, and they want to be heard. I'll say, you should get a billboard. Like, they're not that expensive. You get a billboard out there, make it creative, make people talk about it. Suddenly the media will talk about it on talk radio. Maybe the TV will cover it. It's a good way to get some attention. That's apparently what is happening here, a billboard campaign to bring out some grievances with the UAW on broken promises. Let's bring in Charlize Bozzello, the Center for Union Facts Research Director. Good morning. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, appreciate you being here. Tell us about this billboard campaign and what its goal is and what it's going to be all about.
Yeah, so you guys are totally right. I think that billboards are a great way to kind of start the conversation. At least we seem to think so. So this is really the next installment in the Center for Union Facts' ongoing national education campaign regarding the United Auto Workers. We actually launched the campaign a few years back. I'm sure you guys remember when the union's corruption scandal sort of first came to light.
Mm-hmm.
Now that there's a new face at the helm of the UAW, Sean Fain's in charge, we still want to make sure that we're holding the union accountable, pushing for transparency. Like you guys were suggesting, I think Sean Fain and the people he's appointed to his inner circle are a little bit more controversial than a lot of members even realize. So we put this mobile billboard in front of the union's headquarters in Detroit, but we also placed a bunch in key areas across the country where the UAW has been super active and sort of where Sean Fain has been continuing the conversation about his union. We really wanted to meet him in those places and just make sure workers and the public have access to all of the information on the union, not just what's making it into headlines.
So what are the key points that you want people to know through this campaign?
Yeah, so I think you guys touched upon one of the big ones, which is that there are a lot of controversial leaders now at the UAW. Sean Fain has appointed an inner circle that have very strong socialist ties. And, you know, these are people that he's putting in charge. They're not being voted in. They're not really being vetted by membership. And Sean Fain himself, you know, he's rallying with Senator Bernie Sanders, with Rashida Tlaib. And the UAW and a lot of its local leaders have taken a pretty strong controversial stance on the Israel-Palestine conflict. I think that would be, you know, that's very interesting to members who might even be wondering, you know, this is a union for auto workers. You know, why are they talking about something that's happening in the Middle East? And they might not agree with the union stance, but we want to make sure they at least know about it. And then I think there's a lot of, you know, people are touting Sean Fain and his new contracts with the big three as, you know, this huge success. And I think he's really riding the media attention from that. But a lot of workers are unhappy with what they got. And there were a lot of broken promises in the contract. For starters, you know, he was pushing for a 4-day work week. That never made it in. He was pushing for a 46% pay raise. That definitely didn't make it in. They landed at 25 after a 6-week strike. And there were no new provisions for retiree health care, no new pensions. And so a lot of workers found that really disturbing, but they're not the ones who are kind of making it into the coverage on this. And, you know, I think one of his big other issues is job security. Shortly after the contracts were announced, Stellantis announced that they were going to close a bunch of facilities. They announced hundreds of layoffs. GM, I think, has sort of talked about some layoffs in 2024. And so if the goal really is, you know, maintaining and growing auto jobs in the U.S., I don't think it's clear that Sean Fain is really living up to that.
Well, some of my concerns have to do with their positioning on political issues and foreign policy issues. They've been very engaged. Sean Fain has, and as you mentioned, people within the inner circle of the UAW, such as you mentioned, the stance on Israel. They're against Israel, and it seems, anyway, their right to exist. And not to mention some of the statements about policing, some of their views there, and those types of things. What is the role? Why is the UAW, in your view, branching out into foreign policy issues, taking what some would call a radical leftward stance politically? And are they abandoning the traditional role, do you think, in labor rights and economic issues for its members?
You know, I think what's at the crux of this is Sean Fain's real desire to push his own celebrity. I mean, he has never backed down from a chance to, you know, make a headline, or, you know, he recently was slapped on the cover of Bloomberg Businessweek and hailed as, you know, labor's hero. I think he really feeds into all of that. And this is just another way for him to, you know, take stances that get him a lot of play in the media. And when you think about his other political plays as well, you know, he's endorsing Biden, but it wasn't even a simple endorsement. It was a whole, will he, won't he? He really built it up. He did it at the union's big conference in D.C. Really a kind of brilliant plan to get a ton of media play. But I think that's why he, you know, he's pushing to be involved in these, you know, maybe not in these issues that don't really have much to do with what he's doing for workers. And I think workers might have a real issue with that, especially as he's kind of moving to organize workers in the South. I mean, they've always kind of been clear about the fact that the UAW doesn't really share their values. So I'm not sure what he thinks all of this far left activism is going to really win him in places like that.
Well, people can learn more about what you're doing at your website, unionfacts.com, unionfacts.com. Very much appreciate you joining us to talk about this. Charlize Bozzello is the Center for Union Facts Research Director. Charlize, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. 800-859-0957 is the phone number, 800-859-0WJR.
Yeah, I want to go out to Vince in Northville. He has a important point, an angle on this Jennifer Crumbly conviction. Vince, welcome to All Talk.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you?
Great.
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to comment on this. I think this verdict, as sad as it is, this whole case between the family being destroyed by this, is totally horrible, okay? I feel for all parties involved. However, there is a positive note that's going to come out of all this, and that is going to be that these parents that are behind free-range raising, like treating your children like free-range chickens, is going to come to an end. It's going to cause these parents to be more proactive in the day-to-day activities of their children, or else face extreme consequences.
Well,
we all know that this kid was troubled. And to try to say that this was just our young man, this goes by a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. This just wasn't something that happened over a 4 or 6 month period. And his parents were totally blind, or they just didn't care what was psychologically going on with him. And this is going to be a real wake-up call, not only for Michigan, but for every state in the union, because now the state of Michigan has set a precedent for parents. Look, if you've got kids, you're responsible for their actions, and if you don't, you're going to pay severe consequences.
I do think that we have a parenting crisis in this country, and we've talked to many people in law enforcement who say if there's one thing that you know, I could do to reduce crime in our, you know, county, and say it's a sheriff, would if parents had dinner 5 nights a week with their kids, that parents, would solve the vast majority of our crime.
Parents need to stop being afraid of their kids. They got to stop worrying if their kids like them or not. They have to do their jobs, love their kids enough to teach them how to live right. And the dinner table is the perfect place to do that.
Right. You talk things out, and it's always, maybe sometimes it's awkward at first, but over the course of the dinner, things loosen up, people talk, and you get to know your kids and what they're involved in, and it's a tough role. That's why it's a tough role.
Because I think this conviction will save lives. It doesn't mean I'm not worried about it, but I think it will save lives. Thanks, Vince.
Thank you. More to come, 760 WJR. Hey, Kevin, I believe the interview has taken place with Tucker Carlson and
it's
Vladimir Putin.
It's 2 hours long.
Yeah, the Moscow has come out and said that Vladimir Putin has been interviewed by...
You can't believe anything Moscow says.
No, of course not. But maybe Tucker Carlson will confirm this later in the day, that he, in fact, did do the interview. And as you said, it's a couple hours long. And the Kremlin coming out and say, yeah, we did it on Wednesday, which is... Today's Wednesday, correct? So it must have just happened. It is Vladimir Putin's first interview to a Western journalist since that full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago. It was February of 2022.
Incredible to me.
It is. And I guess the question comes, why have Western journalists, not just here in the country, but in Europe, and think about it, Europe, Russia's part of Europe, right? The last I checked. They have not been able to interview Vladimir Putin either. Well, why not? Why has that not been the case? Is it Vlad saying, I don't want to talk to you, or are we just not pushing hard enough
to get the interview? Tucker Carlson last night was saying something kind of interesting, or getting at something kind of interesting. He had accused the Biden administration of trying to put a stop to him interviewing Putin like a year ago previously. And he said, and maybe that was in the works again. He felt like that was in the works again, trying to stop him this time as well. And he said, but we just came over. We just came over.
Just went and did it.
They just went over. Well, yeah. They might not get it. They spent the money. They went over. They said, we're here. We want to do the interview. Can we make this happen? And now it's happened. And it might not have. They might have had to invest money and time in an interview that did not take place. And I just think that on something, I mean, this is a really important interview because we're spending so much money to support Ukraine in this war. And we talk about what are the exit strategies? What's it going to take to put an end to this war? Does Putin have to completely leave the country? Or is Ukraine willing to give up parts of the country? Like what is the end game strategy? Because we're paying the bills. And so we deserve to know. So if you sit Putin down, he says, well, I'm never leaving. I'm taking over the whole country. Well, then that gives you a better idea of what our goals are. We're in this for the long haul until we completely defeat Putin and he's out and he's gone. Or he says, I want this section of Ukraine, which we previously owned, and I want it back. And then you could say, oh, well, hey, Zelensky, are you willing to give up this part? Because right. We don't want a forever war. For this part of land, this piece of land that nobody's in. There's just important questions that need to be asked.
I'm curious if people have a problem with a Western journalist or even a guy like Tucker Carlson going and interviewing Vladimir Putin.
They're calling him a traitor.
They want him
charged with treason.
Right, because he interviewed somebody. And if the Joe Biden administration actually interfered and tried to prevent somebody like a Tucker Carlson or any other reporter, which I believe he probably did based on other things we know they got themselves involved with, in terms of the private industries and those types of things, and that is absolutely inappropriate for a White House to try to prevent. Let's say it was ABC News that wanted to do this interview. They said, no, don't do it. That's not their role. In fact, that's the opposite of what the role is supposed to be.
I saw a lot of people say, I'm not going to watch this. I can't believe anything that either one of these gentlemen say. I think that would be a mistake. I think you watch it. You assess it for yourself. You learn what you can learn from it.
Would they watch an interview with Fidel Castro back in the day?
I think they would. Reporter?
Of course
absolutely.
They would.
Absolutely.
Did they have a problem with reporters interviewing Fidel Castro? No, they did not.
No. It all happened.
Of course.
Of course it did. Give us a call, 1-800-859-0950. You can text us as well, 1-800-859-0WJR. Before we get to your calls, we're going to go to Steve Courtney, WJR sports analyst, with an incredible story about an incredible amount of money that's going to be thrown around on Super Bowl Sunday. Hey, Steve.
Hey, what's going on, Kev, Tom? Good morning to you both. Hello again, everyone. This chat brought to you by the tremendous group at Bill Brown Ford. Hopefully the W's continue to stack up for your wing wheelers. They continue their push to the postseason. Saturday, my good friend Matt Garko and his team are stacking wins each and every day. Drive with the champions at Bill Brown Ford. Shop their TrueView inventory at BillBrownFord.com today. Kev, Tom, remember, not all that long ago, there were office Super Bowl pools all over the place. The problem was you were a little bit skittish because you thought the SWAT team was going to knock the door down and everybody was going to the hooskow. My, how times have changed. Two-thirds of American adults are now living in jurisdictions with legal sports betting. And with that being said, more than $20 billion is expected to be at stake when the Super Bowl kicks off in Vegas for the first time. How about these numbers? Approximately 67.8 million adults, 26% of the adult population of the United States, could combine to bet $23.1 billion on Super Bowl 58 between the 49ers and Chiefs. This according to a survey with the results released just yesterday. The survey, by the way, 2,204 adults. More than $300 billion has been bet with American sportsbooks since 2018. That ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court jump-started the spread of legal wagering. As a matter of fact, fellas, 38 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico now offer regulated betting. Estimated TV ad spend slash media value on sports betting topped $360.1 million in 2023. If you watch virtually any program, I don't have to tell you that the sports betting services are all over the place. Now, how about this? Caesars Sportsbook reported just last week taking a $1 million bet on the 49ers to win the game straight up and a $100,000 wager on the Super Bowl coin flip to land tails. No, it's crazy.
A million on the coin flip?
No, 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 no. Just 100,000.
Oh, 100,000. Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's fine. That's fine. That's,
what a relief.
Tails never fails.
And, Kev, I told you at the time, I thought it was a good bet. So, way to go. The 49ers, by the way, as we prepare for Super Bowl 58 at Allegiant Stadium in beautiful Vegas, it's going to be a 6:30 kick, of course, on Super Bowl Sunday. 49ers are a point-and-a-half favorite now over the Chiefs. And let me just add this caveat in closing, fellas. The 49ers will be wearing white. Why is that important? Well, teams that have worn white.
You bet on it?
They're 16-3 in the last 19 Super Bowls.
Ooh.
So, listen, that's for entertainment purposes only. Don't be coming back to Uncle Steve.
Steve, I lost my car because you said the team that wears white always wins. What's going on?
You know, in 1995, the 49ers were in the Super Bowl. They were wearing their red jerseys, and they won that game. So it's not a fail-safe, is it?
Well, it depends on if the other team wore white or not. We don't know.
The other team wore white.
Oh, they didn't.
No, San Diego Chargers.
This data, Tom, is just for the last 19.
That's why I missed it. Okay.
It's the details. You know, non-related gambling, though. Americans are going to spend $17.3 billion on Super Bowl-related purchases for that day, like merchandise, beverages, food. That's going to be less than what people are actually betting on this game. That is astounding.
Well, full disclosure, my mom has had a Super Bowl party forever, and we'll be spending roughly $3,500 on wings.
Good.
And how much on the squares at that particular party?
Oh, look at the time.
Look at the time. Got to go. Got to run. We'll be over for some wings. All can stay for a few minutes.
Who do you
though.
Like,
appreciate
Steve?
It.
Did you say who you liked?
You know what? Look, I think the great state of Michigan going into this Super Bowl 58 with a slanted view. Many have said publicly that they're not going to watch because of obvious reasons. Of course, I'll be watching. It's the Super Bowl, for crying out loud. And I, for one, am a big Andy Reid guy. And
You're a Swifty. You're not an Andy Reid guy.
Well, you know what? I leave it to you to bring her into the equation there, Kev. Mm-hmm. I am not going to go against the Chiefs. That's just me.
I'm going NFC. Go 49ers.
Brock Purdy.
We'll find out. All right. Appreciate it as always. WJR sports analyst Steve Courtney. Thank you, Steve.
Enjoy the day, fellas.
You do the same thing. Quick break. Kevin Dietz and myself, Tom Jordan, returning right after this. 760 WJR. There is a group of city and county leaders, municipality leaders, who are endorsing some legislation that's aimed at ensuring that water is affordable. It would cap water bills for low-income families and protect against shutoffs, and it sounds great. However, and this is a big however, the opposite is true for residents in Macomb County. Many other bills would actually go up because of this legislation, Kevin, and that is what is concerning to the Public Works Commissioner there in Macomb County, Candace Miller.
Well, there's a huge problem in Southeast Michigan. This is going back a couple of years, and the vast majority of communities were doing just great, paying all their water bills, and one community just would refuse to pay theirs. They just wouldn't pay, mm-hmm. and they'd keep using the water, and the rest of the communities are like, this isn't fair.
Right.
This community needs to pay just like the rest of us. And now it seems to me, I could be wrong, but it seems to me like the solution is this new assistance program where we all pay a couple extra bucks a month to help those who need assistance. That sounds like the same thing to me.
Yeah.
They're going to charge the people who are paying their bills to pay for the people who don't want to pay their bills or who aren't paying their bills.
The previous thing was Highland Park. They weren't paying the bills. Everyone else had to make it up.
Yes.
And now
they're calling it assistance program.
Yes.
If it's truly for those who need assistance, okay. But if it's to Take the burden off of pay for the people who don't want to pay, who refuse to pay. I don't like it so much. Anyway, joining us now is Candace Miller, Macomb County Public Works Commissioner, who I'm sure can do a better job of explaining this to me and to those who are out there. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, very well, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. What is at the heart of this? And is this a fair? People just want fairness.
Well, first of all, you're spot on with your analogy about Highland Park. I mean, the suburbs paid $60 million of their bill, and then the state gave them another $75 million just in the last budget to improve their infrastructure. And so I don't know what lesson they learned from that, but does anyone seriously think they will ever pay their water bills again?
No.
And this is more of the same. And it's not just Macomb County, by the way. I'm speaking out for Macomb County. But we, first of all, let me say this. We are pro-water affordability. Obviously, you have households that need to have some assistance with their water and sewer bills. You don't want to shut their water off. They can't afford it. I got that. That's why we already pay into a program. It's under the Great Lakes Water Authority, of which there are over 100 communities in southeast Michigan, most of the state, actually, that is in the Great Lakes Water Authority. We already pay into a program. Now, in Macomb County, that particular program, it's called RAP, but that program generates about $1 million a year in Macomb County. It stays in the county, and everybody in Macomb County that meets the eligibility is already getting assistance. So we feel a moral obligation. We're doing what we need to do. We don't even use all of our money that we generate, and we send it to Detroit every year because they always need so much. Oakland County only uses half of their money, of which they send the balance to Detroit. And, you know, this is a new fee, a duplicative fee, and I'm just going to tell you exactly what this is all about. It's not just Highland Park. The city of Detroit last year, a year and a half ago, started a new lifeline program, which they used COVID dollars, federal dollars for. They have over 40,000 households on that, and they have basically said, well, look, that's not sustainable. We're running out of money. And this is what they've come up with. And everybody in the state, it's not just Macomb. If you are a water meter user in Mackinac County or, you know, Lapeer County or St. Clair County, anywhere in the state of Michigan, you are now about to pay into this program. And you can guess where it's all going.
This feels like some fancy marketing deal. Hey, we're all behind this assistance program. And it sounds to me like Highland Park figured out a way not to have to pay their bills, and Detroit's like, hey, we want in on that. Let's do that too. How does Mayor Duggan get everyone to go along with this idea?
Well, when you said there were all these local elected officials that stood up, I mean, I'm just saying this is not a bipartisan thing. It's not bipartisan. Let me just leave it there. But anyway, I mean, not only is this fee going to help folks that need help with their water affordability, it will go directly into the coffers of the utility. So let's say the Detroit Water and Sewer Department. And I'm just going to tell you what Gary Brown said about this fee. We can hire more people. We can buy material. We can do engineering.
Oh.
That's what they're going to. I mean, yeah. I got the moral responsibility. We're doing what we morally have to do in Macomb County, and we're giving more money to Detroit if we don't use ours. But I do not feel a moral responsibility to pay for Detroit's infrastructure needs when we have plenty of infrastructure needs in Macomb. And I'm only speaking for Macomb, of course, since I'm elected here, but I'll give you one quick example. Sterling Heights alone, they have about 100 households on our RAP program, about 100 households. Under this new fee, over and above, we'll continue with the other program, but with this new fee, they will pay almost $2 million a year, every year. I mean, believe me, they have infrastructure needs.
I think you just hit it right there, because you're right. If there are people who can't afford to pay their bills and you want to cap it at whatever, 3% of their total income, maybe that's okay. But if you're admittedly using the funds to pay for your infrastructure and then other counties across the state are going to pay for it, that does not seem right. And we talked about this lifeline plan about a year ago, and one of the questions was, is this sustainable? Because that money is going to run out, and it looks like it has run out, and they've got to fill it up somehow. What are some alternative funding mechanisms that you can come up with? Because the need is there.
The need is there.
Is there a way to deal with that need specifically in another way that's much more affordable? It's not going to affect Macomb County and other counties across the state.
Well, I would say that the state legislature, if they feel this is such a moral obligation that they have to pay for this Lifeline program, then I think they need to take it out of their general fund. Because even this legislation they have, they keep going, well, this is statewide. Well, it is if you have a water meter. But let's keep in mind, over 30% of the state is on either a well or a septic. So that even means more of a burden, obviously, onto communities that are, you know, like us in Macomb County. So that would be one thing I would consider, have them consider doing. Now, they also keep saying, well, there's not going to be enough money in the WRAP program. You're soon going to run out, which is absolutely untrue. Even if it were true, all we have to do is have a vote on the Great Lakes Water Authority Board, which we have a representative on, to raise the rates slightly in Macomb County. Whatever it would be, a very small percentage. And all that money then stays in Macomb County, and we keep helping our folks in Macomb. Oakland can do the same. Wayne could do the same. Detroit could do the same. Right. There's been talk on the board about that. Of course, they go, oh, no, we don't want to do that because we're going to get everybody else to pay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The infrastructure. I don't feel like Detroit's infrastructure should be paid by the people who are already paying their bills, paying their water bills now, and telling them to pay more. If Detroit's got a serious problem, why don't they go to the feds and say we need help, or to the state and have the entire state help pay for it? I think it just feels like you're really punishing the folks who are paying their bills already here.
You know, here's something that I keep saying. When you look at this, the fee is not based on consumption. So it doesn't matter how much water you use, you know,
right.
If you're a household, if you're a single, let's say you're a widow, you live in East Point, you're one person in a house, you have a meter. So does the Walmart on the next corner. They have one meter. They are paying the same as what this poor old woman is going to say. I mean, how can that possibly be fair? This thing has got so many holes in it, but I mean, I'll tell you what, you mentioned about a marketing. It's a great marketing thing they got going on here. And anytime anyone objects, they say, oh, it's all about, you know, it's a moral thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're immoral if you don't do this.
There's a larger issue at play here. I mean, if you in Macomb County, you're not using all the funds from the Great Lakes Water Authority's, you know, the residential assistance program. You're not using them all. You're giving them to Detroit. Sounds like Oakland County's doing the same thing. And that's still not enough. There's another much more fundamental issue at play here. I wish we had time to get into it. We don't. But I appreciate you coming on the program. Candace Miller, Macomb County Public Works Commissioner. Candace, thank you. Hey, I like the boldness of this. It's not going to happen right away, but it was an ask that Donald Trump did to President Biden. He says, I want an immediate debate with you, you know, and President Biden responded saying that, you know, yeah, Trump's got too much time on his hands. I'm awfully busy right now as the president, so I don't have time to debate the former president, I says. But anyway, it's intriguing enough to say, okay, well, what if they did debate? Could that happen early? We're still in primary season, but could they debate? And the other question, Kevin, I have is, are they ever going to debate even after the primary season is over?
No, they're not. Let me help you out with that. They are never going to debate, and I'm so sad. I want this debate so badly. I think I would watch an AI debate between these two. So maybe we should make some money.
Put on virtual goggles on?
Put on virtual goggles and watch these guys, watch AI characters of these folks debate. I think it would be so fascinating, and I think it could be so good or so bad for Joe Biden. If he did well, I think that would be the end of it, of talking about how he can't handle himself. And if he did poorly, he would be done for. Risk-reward, I think it's not going to happen because I think there's too much risk, not enough reward for Joe Biden. But I could be wrong, and I hope I am, because I love presidential debates, especially one-on-one with one person from each party. Or throw the independent in there as well. I'll be fine with that. Let's bring in Aaron Call, U of M Director of Debates. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah, thanks for being here. What you make of the offer? Was that just kind of Donald Trump making some noise rather than have an official plan for an official debate?
Yeah, I think, you know, he was on a radio show and this kind of stuff comes up, you know, in those venues. But also I think it was, you know, Trump is being pressured by Nikki Haley to debate, given that there's just two candidates left in the Republican primary. And previously he said that if it got down to a two-person race and it was a little closer, you would consider doing it. So I think it's, in addition to just showing his really desire to debate Biden because they think it would be good for him. It's also, you know, meant to kind of snub Haley and take some pressure off her calls for him to debate. And she also did that on Saturday Night Live, calling, you know, Trump's not debating them. And he's just showing, oh, I'm really just focused on the general election as a presumptive nominee.
Yeah, well, I think Donald Trump loses all credibility when he refuses to debate his own party, people running in the primary, and then says, hey, Joe Biden, you need to debate me, get up here and debate me. He should. I think Donald Trump should have debated in the primary, even if he didn't do well, because I think he would have still come out ahead of everybody by far, even if he didn't do as well in the debate, and even if the moderators were out to get him, then at least he would be able to say, "Hey, I debated Nikki Haley and others. Joe Biden needs to come out here and do that," and then maybe voters would have held him accountable. Does anyone hold anyone accountable if you don't debate anymore?
Not in this cycle. It used to be that were the case. Back in, you know, Trump famously skipped the Iowa debate in 2016 and was favored to win the Iowa caucus and ended up losing to Ted Cruz. And a big part of that was him not participating in the debate. And even Trump, after the fact, admitted that and said, yeah, I should have done it. But this cycle has been totally different. The polls have shown that people don't really require or expect him to participate in the debates. I think for a few reasons, he has been president, and so he's a known commodity. People think that they know what they're getting and what his positions are and all the issues, and so what would the debates really do in order to clarify those things? He's really, even though he's not the incumbent president, he's kind of being treated as one, and just like Biden, some of the Democrats running against him are saying debate, but now he's the sitting president, so he doesn't want to do that, and Trump, while not the president, is kind of getting that same credit from voters. So no, there's no penalty or accountability of that now. Nikki Haley, before DeSantis dropped out, decided not to debate DeSantis twice in New Hampshire, and she went on to get second place in New Hampshire. And so now, as of now, and ultimately that'll determine it. If in going into the general election, if there's enough pressure and people demand it, then the candidates participate. But if not, and there's no political penalty they pay, then there's really no point to do it.
I really do hope that the public demands this and there's enough pressure on both of these candidates to do so, because we've never seen anything like this where there's two candidates who are effectively, I mean, they both have their own records as president of the United States. To put them back to back would be phenomenal to see. And I know that Biden said this time, you know, Trump has nothing else to do. That's why he wants to debate me. But he won't be able to say that come the general election. But I don't think Biden's going to debate even then. He's going to come up with maybe an excuse or something else is going to happen. What do you think about that? Do you think that Biden will or will not debate? And if not, what would be the reason that he would give?
Mm-hmm. I think in the end there will end up being one or two debates. Like you said, I think the public will demand it. It'll, you know, be a real spectacle. Some of these debates, the audience have reached a size of like 80 million people. And so just something like that, that there's such interest in and would be so watched, it'd be very tough to avoid. You know, it's like almost be like canceling Super Bowl, that everyone is going to be watching this weekend because there's a lot of interest in it. If he declined, I think that there'd be several excuses that Biden would use. I think he'd start out by making the argument that you did, that Trump made a decision not to participate in the primary debates, and it was something that the Republican National Committee had warned him about. You know, if you don't debate this time, the Biden's going to use this as an excuse and not debate in the fall. And so I think he'll bring that up. He'll try to use those same words that against him. And then I think the second main reason he would say just that is that, you know, Trump says a lot of things that are dangerous and not true. And yeah, he's talking about how the election was stolen and those things, and that he thinks that because that, and there's no ability to kind of fact check or censor in real time, that a lot of those beliefs are so dangerous that they shouldn't be exposed to a wider audience and tens of millions of people. So I think that's right. Probably the two things.
I think that's seemingly the way it's going to go, because we've heard other networks not even cover Donald Trump's speeches after he's won primaries based on they think he's too dangerous. The debate commission, though, has scheduled three general election debates already. There's no confirmed participation from either Trump or Biden in those. What are the challenges there? I mean, they're going to put this all together. I'm sure they'll get the moderators and the networks to agree to this without a confirmation that is going to occur. What kind of challenge does that present for these members of these debate commissions?
Yeah, I mean, this Commission on Presidential Debates has been doing this now for decades. There were supposed to be three last year. There only ended up being two because of a dispute on, type in person, online, and also the moderator. And so there's and historically Trump and the Republican National Committee said a lot of negative things about the commission, that they're biased and they're never Trumpers, and there are many people kind of on the board and they pick moderators who are too liberal. So there still is a lot of consternation, difficult to be at that. But I think that could be overcome, because even Trump has said in his, we should debate, I want to debate Biden 10 times. He said, even if it requires me to accept these conditions by the commission on presidential debates and the moderators, I'll do it, because I still think that I will, do so, look so good, and that Biden will stumble. I think that Trump's willing to do it, even if, it put aside the problems he's had in the past. And, it looks like there's leadership change now coming in the RNC. And so I think that also could kind of smooth that over. But there'll always be dispute about things like moderators, because there's just no perfect moderator anymore that everybody on both political sides trusts. And I think you could have another fallback option where if the Commission on Presidential Space can't get it done and there's too much disagreement there, you could just go back to the old way where the networks would just try to do it on their own. So they'd pitch different networks with different moderators, different times and locations, and just take the commission out in total and kind of go back to like what we've seen in the primaries recently. So I think that's also a potential to get to make sure that at least the debate is there.
Well, here's hoping that the debate does occur at least at some point during the general election. And when that happens, we'll have you back on to talk about it, as we like to do. Very much appreciate your time this time as well. Aaron Call, University of Michigan, Director of Debate. Thanks, Aaron. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
All right. Have a good one. We will take your phone calls and get your text messages up next here. It's 800-859-0957. Again, it's 800-859-0WJR. Republican Party's been very critical of the debate commission. I remember last time around in 2020, there was a lot of accusations of bias against the moderators. And one of them I kicked off because he was so biased ahead of time. So Donald Trump's been very critical, as the RNC has as well. But he says, listen, I'm totally willing to do these debates with the same debate commission that I don't like, so long as Joe Biden agrees to also debate me. I think it'd be very entertaining for us. I think Kevin and I agree on this. We'd like to hear what you think. Would you like to see a debate? Is it going to happen between Joe Biden and Donald Trump? Presuming, of course, that both of these gentlemen will be their respective party nominees. That's 800-859-0957.
I sure think Biden made a mistake in turning down this Super Bowl interview, because those Super Bowl interviews are softball questions, and it's an opportunity to just say really whatever you feel like
saying.
Something
happened
last
year,
though. He didn't do it last year. He said no last year.
It was maybe I'm thinking 2 years ago.
He said no last year because it was Fox.
Is that what it was?
But this is CBS. There's no reason for him to say no to this one. But the fact that he has said no, what it does is it gets all the anti-Biden people fired up to say he's too feeble to be able to even do a Super Bowl interview. So how could he possibly do a debate with Donald Trump? And I think he's going to get pressured hard to be forced to do a debate on the issue of, are you mentally capable of doing one?
Well,
and he
sure
could have sat down and said, look, I did the Super Bowl interview. I don't need to debate him because Donald Trump's dangerous.
I did the Super Bowl interview.
No, because it would give him more credibility. The fact that he skipped the Super Bowl, and then if he were to skip the debates, I think he would have a lot of trouble with independents wondering if he's healthy enough to handle a real interview. He doesn't do them, He just walks by, takes a question from the crowd, and then says something.
Yeah. Well, so last time, that's what it was. It was Lester Holt with NBC News. They did the interview back in 2022. That was the year the Rams won, right? Against the Bengals out in Los Angeles. But I guess we just saw just pieces of it. It was a kind of a short interview. Anyway, that was the last time he did it. You're right. A softball interview, he should definitely sit down.
Absolutely.
And do
huge
it with
audience.
CBS News.
Lots to say. 1-800-859-0WJR. Let's go to Mike in Livonia. Mike, welcome to All Talk.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think it would be entertaining. I'd like to see that debate. I can understand why, Trump didn't debate Nikki Haley. I mean, she lost the election when she was only one on the ballot yesterday in Nevada. So, yeah. I mean, that's kind of a waste of time. But with Trump and Biden, I think you've mentioned some 80 million viewers. I think you'd
right.
do better than 80 million.
I do, too.
I think that would be something that I just don't think Biden's handlers are going to let him do it, though. And I think that's the problem. you see him, you know, some of these things.
Not now, but when it's just two candidates, if it's just two candidates, it's going to be hard to get away from it. The American people are really going to demand that he at least do one. But I'm with you. I don't think he's going to do it either.
He ought to. You know, but, and I think you've noticed also, Mike, whenever Joe Biden does his debates, suddenly he's really peppy and he's on the mark and he seems energetic. And it's like people are saying, okay, well, how is he suddenly this way when most of the time he's not? So whatever they do to him prior to the debates, they can do again. Unless he's too far gone, it won't work this time around. Juicing him up.
Juice him up. It's just an hour. You got this, Joe. Let's go out to Howell and check in with Tim. Tim, welcome to All Talk.
Hey, I was just talking to your guy on that answer.
Sure.
And I said, they can't pump enough drugs into Joe Biden to make him a match for Trump. And I don't think he should have to debate Nikki Haley because Nikki Haley came in second in a race where nobody else was running.
I think
it's fine.
I think Trump should have debated when everybody was up there, when Ramaswamy was up there and DeSantis was up there and Haley was up there. I would have liked to have seen him up there. He would have held his own. If the moderators and all the rest of them were against him, Trump would have done just fine on his own. I don't think it would have hurt him too much. I'm not disgusted that he didn't do it. I just think it's good for the country to get everybody up there.
The only reason why I understand why he didn't do it is because this is oftentimes the political take. If you're so far ahead in the polls, you don't engage in these debates. I don't like that. That's typically the tradition. That's the way it typically goes for politicians. If it's not politically expedient, why take part in the debate? But I still would have liked to have seen him at all the debates with all the various candidates that are out there. For sure.
Absolutely. Let's go out to Franklin and check in with Chuck. Chuck, what's going on?
Well, Kevin, I hope you have your flame retardant suit on because your discussion of the Tucker Carlson interview of Putin has my flamethrower fired up.
Uh-oh.
Tucker's teasing video said a day ago that not a single Western journalist has bothered to interview Putin. That's a quote. That was so false, so outlandishly phony that Christian Amanpour of CNN said, wait a minute, we've all asked him. The BBC's Russia bureau said, no, we've been asking him for interviews. The Wall Street Journal's Russia bureau chief said, yeah, we've been asking him for interviews. There's 1,000 exiled Russian journalists.
I thought he said haven't done an interview with him.
No,
guys, I've got a quote.
That's actually exactly what you just said. If you were wrong, that's fine.
Tucker said not a single Western journalist has bothered to interview Putin.
That's exactly true. What's wrong with that?
So requesting is not enough. I was a journalist here for 20 years when I was doing the news. All kinds of people requested interviews with people. You know who got them? The people who went and fought for them. The people who went and sat outside their offices, who went to their houses. The people who demanded to be interviewed. Not the people who put a request into to the PIO officer.
Yeah, so it's... Go ahead, Chuck.
The problem, boys, is that Tucker isn't really a journalist. Tucker's been sued now.
That's not the problem. So, Chuck, okay, listen.
No, wait, let me finish, Tom.
Well, it is a problem, but it's not the problem.
But if he's not a journalist, he's the only one doing the interview. And why did he?
The journalist didn't do the work, so they had to send Tucker.
Back to your point, Chuck, he's the only one that bothered to fly to Moscow to track him down with no confirmation yet that he was going to get the interview. That's what journalists do. Since they didn't do it, Tucker Carlson stepped into the role.
Is not a journalist. Is he a traitor?
Is he a traitor?
What is he?
Tucker is not a journalist.
What is he?
Fox has been sued a number of times for Tucker's on-air defamations, and in all of those cases, Fox goes to great lengths to say Tucker's running a viewpoint show. Tucker's an opinion.
He is.
He's more of a journalist now than he was at Fox.
Right, but you're right.
He
is an opinion guy. But listen, if Rachel Maddow had done the interview with Vladimir Putin, I would have been fine with that. She's not a journalist either. She's an opinion host, and she's also spewed all sorts of lies on her network as well. Again, that's not the issue. The issue is who's going to do the interview. And if it's not a quote-unquote journalist, at least it's someone who interviews people for a living that's doing it. And that is what Tucker Carlson does.
Let's watch it, Chuck, and then give us a call back. Appreciate it. Let's go to Detroit and check in with David. David, welcome to All Talk.
to talk to you guys. Boy, you covered a lot of stuff today. Hey, I just like to you guys brought up President Biden. You know, like it seems like he's chirpy sometimes, and other times he's kind of in outer space. But you notice when he's chirpy, he's got his collar up, and that is where, if you're in the medical world, you realize that's where the injections go for him, for pain or for whatever. No, really,
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, you know, you'll notice it. Look at the films of him, and you'll notice he's got his collar up, and he's real chirpy. But when his collar ain't up, he's like, you know, so check that out, guys.
He can wear his collar wherever he wants, but he's got to get up on that debate stage and make sure the American people know he's healthy enough for another 4 years if he wants votes.
Yeah, we'll look for the Elvis look, too, the next time this happens. Appreciate it very much. Fox News next, followed by Paul W. Smith, 760 WJR.